Imagine waking up tomorrow, right? You check your phone and you find out that a single computer program just wrote 2.5 million highly targeted scam messages, and it wrote them in your native language, completely instantly cloned your bank's login website down to the very last pixel, and stole $20 million. All while you were just, having your morning coffee. But the absolute craziest part of that whole scenario, that program was actually built by
I
Google.
mean, it is the ultimate nightmare scenario for the tech industry, to be honest.
Absolutely.
Moving from this, theoretical danger that we always talk about to just real-world devastation literally overnight.
Yeah, and that really sets the tone for everything we are looking at today. So welcome to the deep dive.
Glad to be here.
We are taking a look at a massive stack of notes from the latest Tech and Night Tech Roundup. This is dated Sunday, June 14th, 2026.
And we're breaking down this historic weekend where the futuristic technology we've been hearing about for years, I mean, things like artificial intelligence, decentralized finance, and, foldable glass.
Right, all the big buzzwords.
Exactly. Where all of that collided spectacularly with real-world law, regulation, and actual consumer adoption.
Yeah, the overarching theme jumping out of these sources is just undeniable.
Yeah.
We are officially out of the sort of experimental phase with this next generation technology.
Right.
Like the theoretical space where nothing breaks and nobody really gets hurt, that's just gone.
It's totally gone.
We have fully entered the phase of, consequences and mass adoption.
Okay, let's unpack this because we really have to start with that Google story.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are currently suing a Chinese cybercrime network called Outsider Enterprise. And the wild part is they aren't suing them for hacking into Google servers.
No, not at all.
They're taking them to court because this network actually took Google's own AI model, Gemini, and they weaponized it to execute this massive phishing campaign. They targeted over 100,000 victims, and it was mostly like crypto investors.
Yeah, the sheer scale and speed of that operation are just staggering. But understanding how they did this is crucial, I think,
Right.
because this wasn't just a group of hackers, manually typing prompts into Gemini, asking it to write a scammy email.
Like copying and pasting.
Exactly, no. They built an entirely automated, self-sustaining pipeline.
Right. The sources actually detail how they use Gemini's language models to instantly write these culturally accurate, highly convincing phishing texts. And they did it in multiple different languages simultaneously.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah. But they didn't stop at just the text. They paired that AI output with automated HTML and CSS generators.
Right.
And I mean, for anyone not building websites every day, those are essentially just code generators that instantly build fake websites.
So they could automatically spin up these perfect visual clones of legitimate banks or crypto exchanges and even like Google's own login pages.
Just on the fly.
Completely on the fly. And then they blasted those out through these mass SMS gateways.
Wow.
I mean, it is an entire cybercrime syndicate, basically compressed into a single software script. So now Google is seeking a restraining order, and they're actively working with the FBI to tear down this network's entire infrastructure.
I mean, I have to play devil's advocate here, though, for a second,
Sure.
because this feels a bit like, I don't know, suing a crowbar manufacturer because someone used their tool to break into a house.
That's a good point.
Granted, in this case, the crowbar basically swings itself,
Right,
right?
right, right.
But how much responsibility does the toolmaker really have when someone misuses a completely publicly available language model?
Well, what's fascinating here is that Google isn't necessarily arguing they're like legally liable for the break-in.
Okay.
This is more of a strategic offensive maneuver.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is a historic precedent because it's the very first time a major tech giant has taken direct, aggressive legal action over the abuse of its own artificial intelligence.
So they're going on the attack.
Exactly. Google is actively trying to establish the legal frontier here.
They want to show they are the sheriffs of their own town, basically.
Right. By taking this all the way to federal court, they are sending a message to governments around the world proving, hey, we police our own ecosystem.
Yeah, look, we've got this under control.
Exactly. But the brilliant secondary effect of this whole strategy is the pressure it puts on their rivals.
Oh, wow, right.
By doing this, Google basically forces the hand of OpenAI, Meta, Anthropic, and Microsoft.
Because if they don't do it,
Right. If those competitors don't spend the money and the resources to take similar legal action against bad actors abusing their models, they risk looking really irresponsible by comparison.
That makes a lot of sense. Google is trying to preempt government regulation by showing they already have the situation handled.
Yep.
But, I mean, if OpenAI thought they could just follow Google's lead and avoid the government entirely, they were completely wrong.
Oh, totally wrong.
Because the government has already arrived at their front door.
The timing on this is just incredible.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, just 5 days after OpenAI announced its historic $150 billion IPO on June 8th, they got hit with this massive legal reality check.
Right.
A coalition of 42 state attorneys general, led by New York, by the way, hit OpenAI with a sweeping subpoena.
And it's huge.
It is. And looking at the scope of this investigation and the sources, they are leaving absolutely no stone unturned.
No, they're digging into everything.
Right. They are probing OpenAI's advertising policies to see if, like, user data is secretly being harvested for targeted ads.
Which is a huge concern.
Yeah. And they're looking into health data management, specifically how ChatGPT protects the privacy of users who, you know, use the AI to diagnose their medical symptoms.
Right. People asking it, why does my stomach hurt?
Exactly. And they're also demanding full transparency on safety controls for minors.
Wow.
So what does this all mean? The source points out that 2026 is an election year for a lot of these politicians.
Right.
So is this just political theater to grab headlines, or are these state attorneys general filling an actual void?
Well, looking at it impartially, based on our sources, you really have to examine the structural reality of U.S. law right now.
Okay.
The United States still lacks a comprehensive, unified federal law governing artificial intelligence.
There's just nothing there.
Right. There is a total regulatory vacuum at the federal level.
Yeah.
So the state attorneys general are essentially stepping in to fill that void themselves.
Makes sense.
But the immediate risk for OpenAI is that this creates a complete nightmare scenario.
Because of the different states.
Exactly. A 50-state regulatory patchwork where the compliance rules literally change every single time digital data crosses a state line.
Oh, man. And an IPO demands total transparency.
Right.
You can't exactly ask institutional investors for billions of dollars if your entire business model might just be outlawed in California or New York next month.
Which is exactly why this is highly likely to end in a settlement. I mean, OpenAI has already stated they intend to engage constructively.
But wait. If they settle with 42 states simultaneously, doesn't that essentially allow OpenAI to, like, co-author the rule book?
Basically, yeah.
Like, they agree to massive transparency reports and really expensive third-party audits. That looks great for consumer protection on the surface.
Sounds good.
But doesn't it also establish a baseline cost of doing business in AI that is just astronomically high?
That is the crucial insight right there. This is a form of regulatory capture.
Regulatory capture.
Yeah. Okay. By setting the compliance standard incredibly high, OpenAI sort of pulls the ladder up behind them.
Oh, wow.
Because a small startup building a new AI model in their garage, they won't be able to afford the army of lawyers and third-party auditors required by a 42-state settlement.
No way.
Whatever OpenAI concedes to here will instantly become the de facto standard for the entire AI industry.
So while OpenAI is busy building these massive legal moats around their business, they have also simultaneously demolished the product moats of almost every other legacy tech company.
Oh, absolutely.
Which perfectly brings us to Apple.
Yes.
Because ChatGPT has fundamentally changed what you and I actually expect from our technology. And because of that, at WWDC 2026, Apple completely ripped up its 15-year-old playbook for Siri.
It is a massive philosophical pivot for them.
Massive.
In iOS 27, Siri is finally becoming a standalone app. It actually gets its own icon right on your home screen.
Which is wild. And the features read like a sort of frantic response to OpenAI.
Right.
It now has a text-based chat interface. Mm. It has a searchable conversation history, so you can actually, you know, look back at a recipe you asked it for yesterday.
Just so useful.
Totally. And it features full iCloud sync, meaning you can start a conversation on your iPhone and then just pick it up on your Mac or your Vision Pro.
Seamlessly.
Seamlessly. But here's where it gets really interesting to me.
Right.
Apple's old philosophy straight from Tim Cook was always, Siri shouldn't feel like a robot.
Right, that was the line.
It was supposed to be this invisible, ambient helper just hidden behind a button press. Mm. But now, by giving it an actual app icon and a chat interface, they're basically saying, fine, you win, here's your robot.
Yeah, they really had to abandon that old paradigm because it was mechanically broken for what consumers now want.
It just didn't work anymore.
No, because ChatGPT trained millions of people to expect extended multi-turn conversations.
Let's actually break down that concept of multi-turn conversations for a second, because that's really the core of why Siri used to be so incredibly frustrating.
Oh, definitely.
Like, if I ask an old voice assistant to find a restaurant, and then 10 seconds later I say, actually, make it Italian.
It just completely loses the thread.
Exactly. It forgets what we were talking about.
Right, because it doesn't have the context window to remember what was just said.
And so a standalone app solves that.
Yes, it solves that mechanical limitation perfectly. It provides a persistent visual interface where the AI can basically read the entire history of the conversation to maintain that context window.
So it knows what it refers to.
Exactly. You just cannot have a deep, iterative conversation with a disembodied voice that resets its memory every single time the screen turns off.
It's Siri's ultimate second chance. But I mean, if iOS 27 doesn't deliver a totally flawless experience here, it feels like it could be permanently marginalized.
Oh, without a doubt. And Google Assistant and Amazon's Alexa are facing the exact same existential pressure right now. And this hardware-software integration is critical because Apple isn't just abandoning its old playbook in software. Our sources highlight that they're finally stepping onto the battlefields for the next generation of physical hardware, too.
The foldable smartphone war.
Here we go.
This is the massive tech clash of 2026, because in July, Samsung is launching the Galaxy Z Fold 8. And then just a couple months later in September, Apple is launching its very first iPhone Fold.
The showdown.
And rather than just rattling off a list of processor specs, let's look at the actual underlying engineering here, because these two companies took completely different paths to get to this moment.
It is a classic contrast in corporate strategies and honestly in material science.
Samsung has the battle scars of 8 generations of foldables.
8 years of them.
They dealt with the early peeling screens, you know, the dust destroying the hinges, those incredibly bulky designs.
The awkward teenage years of the tech.
But through just pure brute force iteration, the Z Fold 8 is highly refined.
Yeah, it's impressive.
They've engineered it down to an incredibly thin 4.2 millimeters when it's open, packed in a massive battery, and heavily upgraded the camera systems. Apple, on the other hand, just sort of sat back and waited for physics to catch up.
Pretty much.
They are launching a 7.6-inch OLED inner screen, but the entire device hinges on a material called liquid metal.
And this is where the mechanics of folding glass become really fascinating.
Okay, lay it on me.
So if you take a sheet of glass, or really any traditional rigid material, and you bend it, the physical stress naturally concentrates right at the apex of that fold.
Right in the middle.
And eventually it creases or cracks. So Samsung spent years mitigating this with these really complex sweeping mechanical hinges.
Which were kind of bulky for a while.
But Apple waited for liquid metal, which the sources note is an amorphous alloy.
Wait, amorphous, like not a normal crystal structure?
Its atomic structure isn't a rigid crystal grid. It is randomized. So that means it can deform elastically. It basically absorbed the physical stress of the fold without transferring that tension to the delicate OLED screen sitting right on top of it.
So no crease.
Ideally, yeah. They essentially waited for the material science to solve the screen crease problem entirely before even entering the market.
That is so classic Apple.
It really is. And when Apple enters a hardware category with a mature solution like that, it acts as this massive signal to the mainstream consumer market.
Like a green light.
It tells the average buyer, look, this technology is no longer a weird experiment. It is ready for your pocket. Samsung did the heavy lifting to invent the whole category, sure. But Apple's September showdown is what will legitimize the foldable form factor. If you've been holding out, waiting to see if foldables were just a passing fad, this fall is when the market officially decides they are the new default.
That makes total sense. And speaking of waiting for foundational mechanics to be fully solved, the financial sector has been doing the exact same thing.
Oh, big time.
Just like Apple waited for liquid metal to mature, Wall Street has been quietly waiting for blockchain infrastructure to mature. And according to an interview in our sources with Vivek Raman of Etherealize, that digital infrastructure is finally ready.
This is a major, major shift in the global financial narrative.
It's huge.
Because we are moving away from cryptocurrency as just purely speculative tokens.
Right. According to Riemann, Wall Street is fully out of the sandbox phase.
Yeah.
Traditional finance, what they call TradFi, is actively tokenizing real-world assets on the Ethereum blockchain right now.
Which is wild to think about.
It is. And for anyone not steeped in all the crypto jargon, tokenization essentially means taking a massive physical or financial asset, like a skyscraper or a company stock or a government bond, and chopping it up into digital shares.
Right.
And those shares can be traded instantly, 24/7, on a blockchain.
Globally.
Exactly. And because of this massive institutional adoption, Roman makes a truly staggering prediction. He actually believes the price of Ethereum will hit $15,000 by 2027.
Which naturally invites a very healthy dose of skepticism from anyone who has watched the boom and bust cycles of crypto over the last decade.
I mean, that's my immediate pushback right there.
Right.
If Wall Street is truly tokenizing billions of dollars in real estate and bonds right now, why isn't the price of Ethereum skyrocketing today?
That's the million-dollar question.
Like, a 5x jump to $15,000 just sounds like the same wild hype we've heard forever. What is the reality check here?
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, you really have to look at the mechanics of how this digital infrastructure actually operates today. Think of Ethereum not as a single database, but like a massive, newly built digital financial district.
Like a city center.
Exactly. The main Ethereum network is the central clearinghouse. It is incredibly secure, but it can be slow and really expensive to use directly.
Right, the gas fees.
Yeah, the gas fees. So over the last few years, the industry built what they call layer two scaling solutions. Networks like Optimism, Arbitrum, and Base.
How do those layer twos actually work, though, in this analogy?
They are essentially high-speed trading floors built right next door to the main clearinghouse.
Oh, I see.
They batch thousands of transactions together in milliseconds on these fast floors, and then they just send one final tiny little receipt back to the main Ethereum network.
So they process all the crazy volume off the main floor to avoid congestion.
Precisely.
So the infrastructure is finally capable of handling Wall Street's crazy volume without crashing the whole system.
Exactly. The digital skyscrapers are fully built, the high-speed trading floors are open, but the massive volume of TradFi money, like the trillions of dollars, hasn't fully moved their desks in yet.
Ah, they're still moving in.
Right. Wall Street naturally moves very cautiously due to regulatory friction. So the current price of Ethereum reflects the construction phase being over,
Yeah.
not the fully occupied destination yet.
Got it. So it's a lagging indicator.
Exactly.
The pipes are laid, but the water isn't fully flowing yet.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
I imagine the risk factors are still pretty significant, though. I mean, a competing blockchain like Solana is actively positioning itself as a much faster, cheaper alternative.
Oh, the competition is incredibly fierce.
Yeah.
But Ethereum has a massive advantage in network effects. All the major decentralized finance protocols and now these massive Wall Street tokenization projects, they're already built there,
They're locked in.
basically. The switching costs for a major bank to move all of its tokenized assets to a completely different blockchain would just be astronomical. It is a long-term institutional play at this point.
Which brings us to a fascinating contrast in our sources.
Yeah, this last story is wild.
It really is. We've spent all this time talking about the absolute cutting edge of digital abstraction, AI generating millions of automated messages, invisible algorithmic regulation, and, trillions of dollars being chopped up into digital tokens.
Right.
So what are the crypto millionaires and the tech entrepreneurs, the people actually building this whole digital future, what are they spending their newfound wealth on?
They are fleeing the digital world entirely.
Yes.
They are buying pure physical nostalgia.
Because on June 12th at Heritage Auctions, a sealed 1985 Super Mario Bros. Cartridge sold for a record-shattering $3 million.
$3 million.
It completely crushed the previous 2021 record, which was $2 million.
I mean, the specifics of this specific cartridge really dictate that insane valuation.
Right. It's not just a copy you find in your grandma's attic.
No, definitely not. It's the earliest known sealed copy to even exist. It features an original glossy sticker from Nintendo's very first production run in the test markets, rather than the standard shrink wrap they used for the mass market later on.
That's a crazy detail.
And crucially, it holds a near perfect WADA 9.8 A++ grade.
Right. And for anyone unfamiliar with that grading system, WADA is a company that authenticates and encases these vintage video games in tamper-proof acrylic.
Like grading comic books.
Exactly. They grade them on a 10-point scale for box condition and seal quality. So a 9.8 essentially means it looks like it was printed yesterday.
Right.
But I really have to challenge this valuation.
Oh, I'm sure.
I mean, $3 million for a piece of plastic and silicon that you literally can't even open and play?
Yeah.
Are we just looking at a massive, unsustainable bubble created by bored tech billionaires looking to just park their Ethereum somewhere?
Well, this raises a really important question about how modern society actually assigns value.
Okay.
The experts in the source material suggest looking at this from two distinct
All right,
perspectives.
what's the first?
Yes. On one hand, this is a highly speculative, high-risk asset class.
Definitely.
The astronomical prices are heavily reliant on the concentrated wealth of the tech sector.
Right.
So if the tech economy takes a sharp downturn, the market for multi-million-dollar vintage games could absolutely
The
crash.
bubble just pops.
Exactly.
Yep.
But from another angle, it represents this massive generational shift in what we actually consider fine art.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, video games have graduated from mere toys to legitimate cultural artifacts. To the generation that grew up in the 80s and 90s, who are now coming into massive wealth, a pristine 1985 Super Mario Bros. Cartridge holds the exact same historical and emotional weight as, like, a rare first edition book or a Picasso painting holds for older generations.
Like a museum piece.
Exactly. It is a museum piece of the digital revolution.
It really forces you to rethink what a collectible actually is. And honestly, when you pull all these diverse sources together, it paints such a vivid mechanical picture of exactly where we are right now.
It really does. June 14, 2026 perfectly encapsulates this transition period.
Yeah.
We are watching AI mature from a cool party trick into a force that's powerful enough to trigger federal lawsuits and state-level regulatory capture.
Right.
We are watching experimental technology, whether that's the multi-turn context of an AI assistant like Siri, the complex material science of foldable screens, or the high-speed settlement layers of a blockchain network. All of it is finally being forced to deliver flawless everyday utility.
The grace period is over.
The grace period for new tech is officially over.
And that's exactly why understanding the mechanics behind these headlines is so crucial for you.
Absolutely.
Whether you are trying to navigate how new AI compliance costs might impact your specific industry, or, you're just trying to decide if the liquid metal hinges are finally good enough for your next smartphone,
Right.
or maybe you just want to understand where global finance is actually parking its money. This is the context you
You
need.
have to know how it all connects.
Exactly. But I want to leave you with one final thought, just something to mull over on your own.
Let's hear it.
We started this deep dive talking about AI's ability to instantly clone and fake reality, right?
Yeah.
And we ended by talking about Wall Street tokenizing every digital asset imaginable.
Right.
So with the digital world becoming infinitely reproducible and just completely abstracted, will verifiable physical items like a sealed, untouchable 1985 Nintendo cartridge soon become the only true luxury left?
Wow.
Will the ultimate status symbol in a completely digital future just be something you can actually hold in your hands?
That is a great question.
Something to think about. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Until next time.